Hello and welcome to the Game Developer Podcast. I'm your host, Editor-in-Chief Danielle Riendo, and today we have very special guests, Nick Mikros and Josh DeBonis of Bumblebear Games, who make the 5v5 arcade sensation Killer Queen. We had them on today. We talked all about the game, about game design, about the game's origins as a playground game. It's a fantastic episode. Hope you enjoy the interview, and thank you so much. Today's episode is produced by Jordan Mallory. Thank you, everybody, so much. And I want to welcome our special guests today. We have Nick Mikros and Josh DeBonis of Bumblebear to talk all about Killer Queen. I am very, very excited. Why don't y'all just introduce yourselves? Say hi to the lovely game developer audience.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm Josh DeBonis. I'm the president and game designer at Bumblebear.
And I'm Nick Mikros. I'm also a game designer and desperately trying to be the CEO of this company. I do a lot of things around here.
Yeah, I mean, it's a small company. We all kind of do everything.
Yeah.
Primarily Nick and I are game designers. And I think we're here specifically to talk about Killer Queen when we're the developers of Killer Queen that has kind of turned our company into an arcade company over the last close to a decade.
Yeah. Awesome. I'm very excited, actually, to talk with y'all. I first encountered the game not too long ago. I've sort of followed it from the shadows for years. You know, I've always heard about it. I've heard about the sort of esport component of the game, but I never actually played it until very recently. I was at Wonderville here in Brooklyn. And of course, this is sort of the centerpiece. It is, in case you've never played it, friends, a 5v5, like it's a huge cabinet, a 5v5 multiplayer game, a competitive game, and it really brings the show, I think, every time. And you know, even as a very brand new player, I was able to jump in and have a lot of fun with it. So I'm going to ask you a lot of really dorky design questions.
Great, and I'm really glad you played it at Wonderville. I mean, that's also our home. It seems like we're always bringing new games there to play test them, and that's largely our test bed because it's close by. And our other games are there as well. So
I was going to say, it's such a cool space. It was my first time actually going there. It was just a few weeks ago, which how did this happen? That's the first time I've gone there. I've lived in Brooklyn for so long. I love games. I, you know, write about games. I make little games, et cetera. But, you know, better late than never. And now I'm very excited about the game. I teach game design, and I bring up Killer Queen in a very early lecture every quarter now. The last couple of quarters, I've actually kind of brought it up and been like, look at how cool this game is. So,
Where do you teach?
I actually teach at the Berklee College of Music. So it's always funny. Oh, I'm always like, I'm not a musician, but I teach at a music school.
Just do you know Michael Sweet?
Yes, absolutely. He's in half of our lectures. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we've made a lot of games.
I've made a lot of games with Michael, and so has Josh. Like, before we were even a company, we both worked with Michael, independently.
It's extremely cool.
And actually,
cool.
Michael did the audio on Killer Queen Black, which was our home...
Fantastic.
The home game inspired by Killer Queen.
Yeah, Michael's a national treasure.
Absolutely. I would agree with that. I am loving how many connections there are. We were chatting before this. It's like, oh, we're all in Brooklyn and this is where I played the game. This is pretty cool. Didn't even realize all these things. The virtual is coming into the real. It's amazing.
Brooklyn, you evil, cruel mistress who won't let me escape because there's too many connections here. I could have tiny rent if I lived somewhere else, but no.
It's true. It does. She is a cruel mistress sometimes. It is true. It is very true. I guess here's my segue. Speaking of a cruel mistress, the Killer Queen. There it was. Yeah, I'm going to save that one later. I want to know all about the beginnings of this game, of how you designed this game, of sort of what the inspirations were. I was sort of racking my brain, I was playing the game and I was looking for, of course I work, for basically for GDC and game developers. So seeing if there were any like talks about it, and I never saw a postmortem about the game. So I would love to hear all about it.
We have done a few talks. We did a talk. We did a talk to GDC about the esports community that has kind of grown around the game, which back then it was really in its infancy. And like, I feel like looking back at what we were talking about, some of it's true, but some of it's like kind of bananas.
Some of it's changed a bit. Yeah.
And then we also gave this talk in the hallway. Do you remember this, Josh?
Of GDC?
Yeah, where we were talking about like arcade parts, like joysticks and buttons and how to hook them up and like all that kind of stuff. And they kind of put us in this hallway and people were like walking by, looking at us like we had four heads or something. I mean,
that's something that we've talked about before too, which is like, you know, we've been going to GDC for, I don't know, 20 years probably. Or something like that.
But I mean, I remember when I was in San Jose.
Nice.
Yeah, but every year we feel further and further from that community. Like we as we get more into the arcade space, we're feeling more and more distance. Like we're almost like a foreigner again. It's strange because
I feel like the things that make a great arcade game are almost diametrically opposed to what makes a great home game. It's really weird. The more I design games for arcade, the more I feel like that is true. You know?
Yeah. I want to dig into that. I want to hear all about your thoughts on that for sure. Because that sounds like quite a difficult challenge, especially if you come from one and you're trying to do the other necessarily. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so I can kind of tie all of this together back to the question about the origin of Killer Queen. And there are many places, I guess, you could consider this game to have started, but the very, very roots are in Nick and I making real world games together for this festival called Come Out and Play here in New York City. We were both freelancing for the studio called Game Lab here in New York. That was very formative for me. And I think probably Nick.
Oh yeah.
And we just became friends working there, and we wanted to make a project together, but we didn't really have time to like make a full commercial video game or something. So our friends ran this festival and we said, okay, let's do it. And we made these real world games that have physical components. Like you're running around outside. Or the first one that we made, or one of them, I don't know.
It was the first one. Pitching Pinata Pommel.
So we made a bunch of pinatas in the shape of pigeons and filled them with ping pong balls and bouncy ball candy and all that kind of stuff. And we designed a game around that. And I mean, I guess my point is, these games all had a physical aspect in the way that an arcade machine does. And so now a lot of the work that we do, I mean, we do a lot of what you consider conventional game design, of course, in designing the gameplay. But there's also a lot of the design that's like closer to industrial design in designing the cabinet and how people stand around it and how to manufacture it affordably and as a machine that can survive in a space and make money. And it's, you know, all of these things that we don't really have, we never had to think about when we were doing downloadable games and console games.
How do you make it attractive and attract people without being completely gaudy? How do you like, right? I mean, there's like, like you're creating a physical piece of furniture with electronics in it, you know, and that's a whole challenge in and of itself.
I can imagine. Yeah.
So for that, we made a game called Killer Queen that was a field game that has the same basic rules, more or less, as the arcade game that we know today. But you're, instead of playing on a computer, you're running around outside with foam swords and there's these little balls that you collect, and it feels a little bit like a playground game, like Capture the Flag, but maybe a little bit nerdier and more structure. And it was a response to the earlier games that we had made had a lot of spectacle in them, like the Pinata game was a great spectacle, really fun to play, but not a lot of strategy. It's just like, can you hit the pinata and can you grab the balls and the candy quickly, right? Which is fun, but we wanted to add a little bit more depth and strategy. And so that's kind of where Killer Queen came out of the field game. That was really the origin.
I think the biggest spectacle one, though, and I think we should mention it, was Pitfall Live at the Tank, which was like, it was real live Pitfall, and we were projecting like the game without any of the characters, like without the character, like, you know, we made like our own custom version of Pitfall, and we were projecting on screen, and then we hired this lady who worked, I think, in a circus. Yeah, to install the rope, make sure that that was safe. And then, I mean, I think that early, a hallmark of all our early games was that they were all very dangerous.
Nice.
like really dangerous. People running on concrete to capture ping pong balls and, like, you know, just kind of, yeah.
We made a bunch of fake park permits.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I've done a gig for the parks department, so I had, like, all their, like, kind of official-looking... I knew what an official-looking parks department document looked like, so we kind of just Photoshopped that thing together. And then, so, because we were like, well, if anybody... Because we were playing on a basketball court in the Lower East Side, and, you know, if we were going to get any guff from people who wanted to play basketball, well...
You have to, you know, almost have to engage in a foam sword contest or something for the...
Well, right, yeah, that court, game unfortunately did not have any foam swords, but, you know, I don't think...
Gotcha.
It had baseball bats.
I don't think the nerds would have done it against the basketball players.
That's probably a good point. Yeah. Yeah, understandable. You got to pick your battles. You know, you got to know where your strengths are, you know.
Actually, some of the basketball players joined us, and that was really fun.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
That sounds pretty awesome. I want to see that buddy movie, you know, of like, well, I went to play basketball that day, but instead, you know.
Yeah.
It's been some pretty good times. You know, getting nerds to come out of their homes and do things that are physical.
I love it. As a nerd and a jock combo that I
oh, are you a jock?
My life. I do Brazilian jiu-jitsu.
Nice. I do regular. I do Japanese.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, that's where it came from, of course. So, you know.
No. This is a new thing. This is a new thing.
I see. Okay. All right. That makes sense. That's fantastic. And I love how there's like a very clear lineage there of performance, right? Of like, there's performance in these early games to, you know, just watching Killer Queen is a spectacle and watching the teamwork and watching people get into it. Again, even just me playing with my friends, it was actually a friend's like goodbye party. She was escaping Brooklyn. So this was sort of how we ended up celebrating. And it was like this lovely moment of, you know, both camaraderie and also with our friends on the other team, which was pretty cool. So I can certainly see that. Was it always prototyped that way? Was there always this element of like, it's going to be pretty physical, there's always going to be several people? You know, once you were going from the sort of physical game or like playground game version into a video version, was it always like, it's still going to look like this, you know?
Well, the original version was 16 players. So
oh, okay. Yeah.
It was a little bigger. And then when we did the first digital prototype, like this was before we were even thinking along the lines that we're going to build an arcade cabinet, it was 12 players. And then it got narrowed down to 10 because the cabinet was already so big that, like, you know, but I think actually 5v5 is the magic number. Like, it plays better than 6v6. So,
yeah, definitely. It's also easier to fill out. I mean, it's even at 10, it's a challenge with the game, right? Is to get 10 people together to play it. And it just gets harder the more you add.
That does make sense. Yeah. Although, it seems like a pretty popular machine, or where I was anyway. So yeah, I want to dig in.
Once it gets rolling.
Oh, yeah. Once it gets rolling, that's it. It's full. But it's like... there's that moment when people walk into the arcade, they look at the thing, And they're like, what the fuck is this?
Well, here's a nitty gritty, weird little game design thing. I guess it's weird that we noticed that that was the case, that people saw people playing it, they would join it.
Yeah.
And we always had success early on when we had like one of the first couple cabinets, like we would just be there playing it and testing it and we could get it going, right? But we said, well, clearly we can't be it with every cabinet. So we put footage on the attack screen of other people playing it. And I don't think it's quite as effective, but I think it works to some degree where people see other people having fun playing it and that pulls them in. And in fact, if you look at most of our footage of the game, like when we show trailers and any kind of video or photos of it, you rarely see the actual gameplay. What we show is people standing around the cabinet. And because that's really the experience of the game, right? Is like you standing shoulder to shoulder with all your friends. And it's not exactly what's happening on the screen.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm thinking back now.
Yeah, the game itself, if you were just looking at the gameplay and you didn't know anything about it, it is, you know, it is like kind of hard to understand what, I mean, like you can, anybody can watch Street Fighter and know like in 3 seconds what is happening, right? But with Killer Queen, it's a little bit, there's a little bit more going on, you know, at any given moment. And if you're playing, it's different, you know?
Yeah, there's an aspect of, the strategy itself and how that kind of comes through, right? Of like, okay, I see these little guys doing this, and then this little guy became that little guy, and then, all right, she's around and she has a sword. Like, there's like a very, like, huh, what's going on? That I think, you know, certainly draws a certain type of player in who wants to kind of uncover this. I wanted to ask if the three victory conditions were always sort of a part of the design, or if that came through playtesting, or if that was just sort of like, no, we're going to have different ways, different paths to success here.
It was definitely a goal from the beginning.
Yeah, it was a goal from the beginning, but originally we only really had two victory conditions.
No, we had three, but
we did have three, but two of them were very similar.
Yeah, so
okay.
If to put it in terms of how the video game works, because it makes more sense, instead of having the equivalent of a snail in the field game, we had when one of the flowers was empty, you could basically collect the bucket that the flower was in, or that the balls were in, right?
Oh, so, okay, yeah.
So it was almost like, in the video game, like right now, when you pluck all the berries off of a flower, there's the leaves, the yellow leaves left. It's almost like you could pick those up. And in fact, you know, we have a sprite of a character picking those up, and he's like, it's like draped over his back, like it's really heavy. And I think originally we were going to do something to that effect, but I think we ended up with the snail and thought it was better, so we stopped.
Yeah, I think the conversation went along the lines of like, this is too similar. These two goals are too similar. We need some kind of tug of war kind of element in here. And originally, believe it or not, the game was vertical. So, yeah, which that, don't ever make a vertical game. It's a nightmare. You know, and anyway, so it was supposed to be vertical. And we're like, well, what could climb up walls? And so that's how we like kind of came up with the idea of the snail, because it was going to like, it was going to go up the sides of the screen. But then the universe.
Yeah. In retrospect, it's so obvious that we shouldn't have started with a vertical screen, because our Killer Queen is obviously heavily influenced by Joust.
Sure,
and
yeah.
Joust 2, they were given a business constraint to use a vertical monitor. And the game, I think, is pretty much universally agreed that it doesn't feel as good as Joust 1.
Yeah.
And largely that's because it has the vertical screen as opposed to the landscape screen that that's in Joust. So we should have just looked at that as a starting point. But
here's the thing about, I think if you really analyze Killer Queen versus Joust in the flying, I think one of the big differences is that Joust is way more horizontal than Killer Queen. You know, it's like Killer Queen is very much about columns, right? Like there's like, there's definitely defensive and offensive columns, and you know, it's all about verticality. In Joust, it's very often that you'll go from one side of the screen to the other. Whereas in Killer Queen, it's not so easy. Killer Queen Black is different. Killer Queen Black is more horizontal and diagonal.
Is that because of being more on a home screen for any particular reason, or?
You know, it's like you start off with certain constraints, right? And we knew that Killer Queen Black needed to be playable over the internet, right? And so we needed to build a system that could work well with lag, because you know, people talk about lag in, you know, fighting games or whatever. Try designing a game with, you know, what, 8 players that like is super finicky. Like, you know, when people say like, oh, you should make this a home game, we're like, no, it shouldn't, because that would be a disaster and it wouldn't work. And like, you know, and we really spent a lot of time with Killer Queen Black, kind of trying to capture the spirit of Killer Queen, but in something that would be playable on the internet in a home, you know, in a home venue. So, you know, you start off with one difference that leads, there's a butterfly effect, right? Where one difference then leads to another choice, leads to another choice. And so what you wind up with is a very different game, you know?
Yeah, that does make sense. I'm going to ask you more dorky questions about specific design decisions, if that's okay with y'all as well.
Please. Are you kidding me? You know how many non-dorky questions we get?
Awesome. Well, I want to hear a little bit about how the sort of warrior evolution came about, and how that was it always, you know, kind of having three classes-ish of character, or was there a time where you're like, you know what, we need a little more combat?
No, that was in there from the beginning.
Cool.
I mean, when I say from the beginning, I mean from the field game. The field game went through a lot of iterations before became what it was. But I think that very, very early on, I think that we wanted to have some kind of caste system, kind of like insects do. And
the very initial inspiration was from ants.
Yeah.
Like Nick and I had a meeting at Bryant Park, and Nick said, "Oh, I just watched this documentary about ants or something," because we were talking about what's a systemic theme, because we wanted to add more strategy, right? And so we got talking about ants, and there's like worker ants and soldiers and queens, right? And I think we had that from probably the first brainstorm.
Nice.
Yeah. And then people were just like, oh, those are bees. And we're like, sure. Even though there's no bees in the game. I think at some point Josh was like, well, why don't we just make them bees? And like when we were doing the video game. And I was like, absolutely not. We should not do that. That's too not confusing.
That was going to be one of my questions about like the thematic kind of wrapping and how we got to bees, for sure.
And for the longest time, I mean, it's still kind of true. Like none of the characters have any names. There is no lore.
Yeah.
Like on purpose. There's too much fucking lore out there. Who the hell wants to keep track of one more thing?
It has been interesting. This has started to coalesce, but at least early on when the community wasn't as large and was tied together through the internet, every scene kind of had their own names for the characters or for moves, right? And it was really fun talking to somebody from Chicago and hearing what they call everything versus what somebody from San Francisco calls it, you know? And
what's your favorite name that they came up with?
I like Ska Guy who I usually call Checkers. But I like Peppered Ska Guy.
I think my favorite was, I think it was in Portland. They used to call the workers Backpackers.
I like that.
That's so cute. Yeah. I don't know why, but it's so cute.
I thought that was very funny. I like that.
Yeah.
I just really like Ska, so.
He does. He likes ska, like, and I don't like ska, so we're you know.
Oh, wait, I can picture you always fighting over the radio in the office.
No, actually, we don't. We used to have a programmer, another programmer in the office. Me and him would argue about music all the time because he liked to listen to really bad music.
It's always how it is, you know, when in arguments about music.
Totally. When I first started working with Nick, he had a great policy in his office. Like, before we were working together, he ran a studio called Tiny Mantis. And it was that everybody had one veto for the music per day, right? So if, like, something came on, you could just force a skip, which I really like.
It's a good policy.
We unofficially have that policy, but never have to really use it.
Yeah. Well, there's less of us, too, in the office. Like, I was doing a lot of, like, work for hire games, so it was, like, kind of a bullpen.
We both do really like music, though, and I think that is actually a quality in a lot of our games. You know, Killer Queen, like, the title, for instance, and there is, like, sort of a musicality to the game. And I think you can see sort of, like, there is a through line in our work that other people might not even notice, but I think for us it is, like, a deliberate.
I mean, Black Emperor, it was really important for us to get the sound right, you know?
Yeah.
Like, for it to feel cool, to feel like rock and roll, you know?
Yeah. Is that part of an arcade kind of feel for y'all? Is there, like, a sort of a gestalt of being in a really amazing arcade at a particular year in a particular era, listening to certain music that you want that to be evocative?
I mean, I'm a child of the 80s, and like I don't know, whenever I walk into an arcade, it's like Tom Sawyer by Rush just kind of comes into my brain. Like, it's weird.
Nice.
It's just like, yeah, I'm gonna do well. I'm gonna, you know, whatever. It's like, you know, kind of rocking and, you know, whatever. And like, but yeah, I think, like, the era that I grew up, it was like a lot of sex and drugs and rock and roll and video games and arcades, you know, and like all of that was kind of blended together. And
sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I want you to tell me a little bit about sort of the first arcade iterations. How did you go from, all right, kind of a playground game into a video prototype into a, hey, you know what? This would be awesome in an arcade. How did that all work?
You got a lot of time.
I do.
So we already told you about the field game.
Yeah.
Right? And so the field game actually got really popular. We ran it in a bunch of places. We took it to London. What was the name of that festival?
In Public.
Oh, yeah. Mm. And, like, you know, we were carrying this giant box of, like, foam swords and fun balls and buckets and whatever. And, you know, we're like, you know, what we need to do is we need to make a video game version of this so that, like, we could just, like, show up with a USB stick and a couple of controllers and, like, you know, be ready to go, kind of a thing. I don't know about you, Jock, but I never thought it had any commercial value. Right? Like,
no, it was never our intent. We were both commercial games separate, and this was, like, our way to hang out.
Yeah, this was, like, our hobby. Gotcha. You know, like, this game was our hobby, and we hung out, and we made this game, and we would, like, meet together on Thursdays and blah, 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 and work on it. And, like, we just figured, okay, well, this will be kind of a good advertisement for us as designers, kind of like JS Joust, you know?
Sure.
Which never really got a lot of commercial success or whatever. I mean, they did come out with Sports Friends or whatever, but I don't know how well that sold. So we had that, and so we decided, okay, we're going to make a video game version of it. We know how to make video games. Let's do that. And so the original version of that, the first time we ever played it in public, it was with NES controllers on projected, like, nice. You know, projected on a screen and whatever. And I think it was that Come Out and Play Night Games. And you weren't there, Josh.
I had a wedding. I missed
it. You had a wedding to go to. And then I was there, and it started raining. And I was like, oh, no. So we had to pack up early. But like during the time that it was running, it's like I could tell something's happening.
Yeah.
And then at that festival that we went to in London, we also brought Killer Queen and the video game or whatever.
Actually, at the time, we were calling it Killer Queen Arcade, because Killer Queen was the name of the field game. And at some point, we kind of swapped it, and Killer Queen
became... I don't know if we were calling it arcade yet, because there was no arcade cabinet at that point.
That's true.
Ah.
Did it even have a name? I don't know.
Anyway, so we're in London. There's this giant party going on in the old Vic tunnels. And, you know, a bunch of games. And, like, they've kind of set up this area for us with, like, a screen and blah, blah, blah. And we could not get people off the controllers so that, like, you know, somebody else could play. And, like, I remember looking at you and you looking at me, and we were like, okay, there's something really, there's something here.
Yeah, it felt magical. It was, you could just tell. You know, I've never felt that way about any other game, honestly, like that I've made or that I've played, to be honest. And it just felt special. There was something in the air, you know.
So then, do you know Charles Pratt?
Yes.
From NYU?
Yep.
So we're friends with Charles, and me and Charles had gone to some talk at NYU. I don't remember who it was. But anyway, afterwards, we were drinking at that, you know, and the old NYU location was next to the Apple Bar. And so we were drinking at the Apple Bar, getting drunk. And I don't know, for some reason, we started talking about Killer Queen. And I was like, you know, it's problematic with the controllers. They keep losing connectivity, blah, blah, blah. It's a pain in the ass, blah, blah, blah. If we could have, like, a dedicated hardware, like, you know, like maybe an arcade cabinet, you know, would be good or whatever. And somehow we got onto the subject of, well, you can't charge money for arcade games anymore. And I was like, nah, I think you could. I think if the game was any good, I think you could charge money for it or whatever. It's like, nah, it's impossible. And anyway, so we were arguing, and then I don't know, somehow he was like, well, I'll give you the money to build the cabinet, and it could be part of this No Border show.
Awesome.
And then, you know, whatever, you can do whatever you want. So then the next day I wrote to him and I'm like, hey, dude, I know we were drunk and you offered me this, so I'm giving you an out here, whatever. And he was like, no, I want to honor my drunken word. And so, you know, now we had the challenge of actually doing something that we had zero idea how to do, right? Like we had never built an arcade cabinet. We didn't know the first thing about building an arcade. I didn't even know how, like, to hook up a button, honestly. So anyway, Josh, feel free to chime in at any moment. But
this has been an amazing journey. I am having fun.
Sorry, okay, cool. So
yeah, this is great.
All right, so we did No Border. So then we were like, talking about it. We figured out. I remember we were in the old office down in 10J, and we went to this garbage place. There was like a bunch of cardboard, and we like found a bunch of cardboard, brought it back to the office, and then we were trying to prototype how to fit five people around a cabinet or whatever. And that became like, kind of like, all right, well, yeah, maybe we can do it. And like, you know, one thing kind of was leading to another. And then Josh decided to go to the Bahamas.
Jamaica.
Yeah. He decided to go to Jamaica. And I was like, what? It's like, yeah, I'm going to Jamaica for 3 weeks. And I'm like freaking out. And, but, you know, he came back. And we went upstate and Josh's dad and his brother helped us build the first one. And, you know, then we transported it back to New York, put it together. The show was a huge success.
I think the thing that made me realize how popular it was there was, it was my friend Dana. She said, I didn't get to play your game because the line for free beer was shorter than the line for your game. And I was like, okay, well, that's, you know, that's a good sign.
That's a really good sign. Wow.
And that also was just like a moment when we really realized, okay, there's something here. And also, it was the first time somebody said, oh, well, how much does it cost to buy one of these?
Oh, right.
And
wow.
We became friends with him. He's a really good friend of ours now. But he kind of pushed us to think about it as a commercial product. And we hadn't before that. You know, in fact, I remember saying, like, after we finished it, we said, okay, that was fun making one of these. But, like, we'll never do that again. You know, it just wasn't in our minds. We didn't realize people would want to buy them, that there was a market. And so that Panos is his name. He got us really thinking about, like, okay, how do we turn this into a product? And so we started working with this factory in Wisconsin called Fun Company that we still work with to help us, like, actually construct it in somewhat of a proper manner. I mean, we had the first cabinet that we made. I mean, we really had no idea what we're doing.
In fairness, though, that original pad was lighter weight and indestructible.
Yeah, yeah.
You were onto something.
I mean, and it was all built by hand. Now, you know, now we need to have something that we can cut with, like, a CNC router and sure. be manufactured at a larger scale and things. So that was a whole other process of figuring out how to turn it into a commercial product.
And so at that point, okay, so now I'm going to tell another part of the story.
Yeah.
Which is, so we're starting to get some traction. Killer Queen shows up in some lower bowels of DC where there's a bunch of retro stuff or whatever. And, like, people are just going bananas for it. You know, like, what usually that section where they have, like, that room with some NES controllers and people just walk by, you know, like, and all of a sudden it's like people are actually playing it and whatever. And, you know, we're showing it around. It was at IndieCade. It won Developer's Choice there, blah, blah, blah. And, like, Eugene Jarvis is kind of, like, stalking us a little bit. And we're stalking him, right? And we're, like, definitely kind of doing this little dance where, like, you know, I mean, he's Eugene, right? He's, like, he's kind of this legend. And we're just...
Who is he?
So for those of you who don't know, Eugene Jarvis created, among other things, Robotron, Defender, Smash TV, Cruisin', NARC. He's probably the most famous designer of arcade games ever.
And he's been there from the beginning, and he's still designing games.
And he's still working on games. I mean, yeah. So, anyway, this is going on for a couple of months. He's mentioning us in talks and stuff. And, like, people are texting us and, like, saying, like, hey, I'm at this talk where Eugene Jarvis is, and he's talking about you guys. And we're like, what the hell is going on? So anyway, so we finally, like, are like, okay, let's meet up with this guy, you know, let's do it. And so we fly down to Chicago. We exchange emails or whatever. We fly down to Chicago, and we're really excited. Eugene picks us up and then takes us to his favorite restaurant near the airport, Hooters. And he's, like, trying to convince us that he's there for the chicken sandwich. So we're like, okay.
Classic.
Yeah. So then, like, you know, we start talking and everything. And then he takes us back to Rothrill's, you know, in Skokie. And you know, he's showing us around, and it's all really cool. And then we wind up in this conference room of sorts, right?
Yeah.
And there's this giant mahogany table that's bigger than my office. And we're all huddled up on one side. And he just, I don't know how many hours it was, but, like, he just gives us the brain dump. It was kind of insane. You know, and we were really curious. We wanted to know things and stuff. And, like, I think we owe a lot to him. And, you know, there's been a lot of people along the way that we owe a lot to.
Sure.
But, you know, he's definitely one of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, we worked with them for a while. It didn't really work out. But...
Well, also, so that same day, after we visited their office, we hopped in his car and went to Logan Arcade.
Oh, right.
And this was before Killer Queen was in any public arcades. We were only showing it at festivals. Maybe it was at one arcade out in California. But so he brought us into Logan Arcade and introduced us to Zespy, the owner. And he basically said, you need to try this game, Killer Queen. And he said, sure. I mean, I think when Eugene Jarvis tells you to do something, you do it. And he tried it, and obviously it worked out great. And Logan Arcade really became the hotbed of Killer Queen, and it still is.
I mean, they just had this phenomenal tournament. Like, wow. It was huge.
And yeah, awesome. So I mean, had Zespy not taken a chance on it, which I don't think he probably would have if we had just approached him.
Gotcha.
I think we really owe Eugene for that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we learned a lot about how the game operates in an actual arcade by it being there. I mean, it wasn't even in our hometown. We live in New York. And so we were actually learning more, you know, about it from, you know, a 2-hour flight away. And, you know, eventually we got it in arcades in New York and were able to really observe it regularly. But that was a big first step in, like, trying to understand how to make it work as a commercial game. Because when we were showing at festivals, we didn't need to think about an attract mode or taking coins or, you know, any of the things that make it like a tool for our operator.
Sure.
So that was a whole other thing we needed to learn about. And now I think we understand, and like as we're designing new games, we're thinking about those things from the start. Because we know that's part of our business model. But I mean, as a designer, I have to acknowledge that part of the weirdness and the beauty of Killer Queen came about because we weren't thinking about those things, and we didn't even, you know, it was just never even the goal of it. And so, you know, it's that's part of the magic of it, right?
Yeah.
So it's scary that now we do have to think about those things, right? And of course, we're making decisions that make a lot more business sense in one sense, but it also, like, I worry, like, does that make it more difficult to have that kind of weirdness that Killer Queen has? I mean, it does make it more difficult.
That's a very good point. Very, very, very good point of, you know, this media property thing, game that has had to kind of be translated in some ways, but it has these roots and something that is just joyful, playful, you know, like you mm-hmm. said, it was how you guys would hang out, like,
yeah,
which is pretty awesome.
and really, it was the type of game that we wanted to play.
Yeah.
You know, we had really designed a game for us and I guess 8 of our friends to play. And we do. We still play it to this day. I mean, Nick and I go to tournaments. We're nowhere near at a competitive level compared to, you know, some of the players that have emerged. But we are still an active part of the community and play regularly.
I have to ask, as designers, when you see very high level play, when you see some of the things, some of the, you know, expressive play that very high level people can achieve, does it ever make you sit there and be like, wow, you know, like, oh my, how did they come up with that? Like,
all the time, all the time,
yeah.
All the time. And that's when you know that you've created something great.
Yeah.
You know that you've created something great when it's beyond your initial conception of it.
Sure.
Like, that it's, like, outside of the boundaries of what you envisioned for it, then, like, you know you have something special.
It's especially surprising because we initially designed it to be played at these festivals where sure. you would play it for one night. And of course you have 20 other games to play. So, you know, what somebody might spend 20, 30 minutes with, you know, that was the setting we pictured it in Origin. So we never were thinking that people would even have time to get mediocre at it, much less proficient. to the point where there are people now who've been playing it for, you know, maybe 8 years and are still playing it and are really, really good.
Sometimes I watch them and I'm like, I just don't know. I don't know how you did that, but okay, that's cool. You know, Killer Queen also, it's like, it's kind of like a bumblebee in the sense that, like, it's not a good arcade game, and yet it's a popular arcade game. Like, in the sense that, like, an arcade game, you should be able to pick it up in, like, a minute. It should be, like, instantly understandable. That's, like, the hallmark of a good arcade game. That, like, there's depth, but also it's, like, you can instantly understand what to do. And Killer Queen isn't really like that. And yet, it's like a bumblebee. It can fly, but nobody knows why, you know?
I definitely kept bringing friends over and, like, pointing at the diagram that's like, these are the things right here. All right, you're ready to go. I definitely had that experience, and I thought, like, oh, this is actually pretty accessible considering how deep this can go. And, you know, I could start to, you know, my third eye started opening after playing it for an hour, being like, I can see strategies, you know, and start to pull that in. So it's pretty successful in that way for sure. I did also want to ask, certainly before we wrap up, not that we're wrapping up right away, but before we wrap up, I would love to hear a little bit about the aesthetic choices, about the desire to go with pixel art. I am a massive fan of pixel art. So I, you know, was attracted to that right away, basically. The pixel art, you know, the colors, the, like, wonderful weirdness of this little world, even without lore, it's just very evocative, right? It's a very evocative, funky little world to kind of spend time in. So I just want to hear a little bit about how you decided to go with those choices.
Well, the pixel art, I mean, I can tell you the lie or tell you the truth.
You can give me the truth. I can handle it.
The truth is simple. It's like, I was the artist, me, one person, working on it one time a week.
Wow.
If you have less pixels to draw, then, like, you can do it quicker. So, you know, there was a big appeal to that. And I didn't realize initially that it, like, we didn't know it was going to turn into an arcade game.
Sure.
But it did. Once we had kind of decided we're going to build a cabinet, it was like that, you know, that Tom Sawyer by Rush just kept playing in my head kind of a thing. And I was like, I want this thing to look and feel like it rolled off the assembly line at Williams in 1983. You know, like.
Yeah.
And so it was lucky that we had made this choice to go with pixel art, because it fed into the whole, like, arcade thing, which was good because our, like, we can't get into Dave & Buster's. There's something about it that makes it, like, kind of oil and water with those kind of places, you know? But it does fit really well with arcade bars, which generally are retro places. So it was kind of like we're sneaking. It's like the wolf in sheep's clothing a little bit. Like, we snuck a modern RTS into an arcade and, like, made it look like Joust, you know? So that's where, like, the whole pixel aesthetic came from. And then, you know, like, the cabinet design, I really wanted it to feel like that, have that kind of vibe of, like, you know, old school arcades. And I think, you know, as far as the colors go, like, I mean, I don't know, you just, one decision leads to another, and before you know it, like, there's a world. I don't know. Like, it just felt right. Everything just felt right The thing that never felt right was the original Warriors, which kind of looked like, I don't know if you've ever, like, there was a post yesterday on our Instagram about, which had, like, the old Warrior and the new Warrior.
I have to look it up live while we're, yeah.
Yeah, like the old Warrior, otherwise known as the Hot Dog Warriors, just never quite felt right. So we changed those guys, but that was really...
Actually, the Queen, the original Queen, I always thought looked like a Gary Larson.
Yeah.
Like she was like very kind of a little more goofy looking. Or...
Yeah, and fat. Like big lady. Yeah, so the characters did evolve. But by the time we got it to NYU... It was almost complete. Did it have the Hot Dog Warriors at that point?
Yeah,
I think it did.
Gotcha.
I think it still had the Hot Dog Warriors. And then, now I remember. When, so the Museum of the Moving Image wanted to buy a Killer Queen. This was like the first one we ever made at Fun Company.
Oh, wow.
And so we're like, okay. Because they were doing this show... and they wanted us in it. And so at that point is when I decided we needed to do a little bit of cleanup work on the art.
Sure.
And so that's when we moved to the new Warriors, which kind of look like they evolved from the workers as opposed to, okay, I'm a worker and then I turn into some kind of weird knight. So, and then it was also the point where so the original game, all the workers just had the striped shirt.
Okay. Yep.
So it was really hard to find yourself. So then that's when I also kind of introduced the other three guys, the guy with the skull shirt, abs and, waffles.
Yeah, I have to say, I definitely I looked up the image and I really do love the hot dog night kind of.
But you can also see why we left it behind too, right?
No, totally. I the glow up, it's like a really good. That's how it's phrased on the Instagram post. It's like it's not a phase; it's a glow up. It's very
not a phase. It's not a phase. So that's that. I think we kind of talk a lot about, like, I like to bounce stuff off of Josh. He always has, like, good suggestions and, like, good feedback. So I created the art and everything, but I feel like it was very much a collaboration in that way.
Yeah, Nick and I are really good at filling in each other's, like, weaknesses, I guess. And being able to bounce ideas off. Like, I think we work really well together in that way. Even though we do have a lot of overlap in skills, I mean, Nick can do, like, basically everything in game development. But, I mean, we are both generalists. I think that is maybe part of it. But I don't know. We work really well together, I think, in that sense. And it's rare that we design anything in a vacuum. Like, sometimes... one of us will take lead on something, but it's almost always like, then, we use that as an opportunity to bring it to the other one and really starts to transform. And it's like, one of us will like have some really wild idea. The other one will find a way to make it practical to keep the spirit of the original. I think that's kind of how we work best together.
Yeah, I'd say that's right.
Nice. That actually sounds super awesome and, both healthy and incredibly fulfilling creatively, that it actually is sort of like a nice way to bounce things back and forth, get them better. I always like to ask folks if they feel more comfortable working in more of a jack of all trades generalist capacity or, folks who are hyper-focused and doing the Voltron thing of like the best five of whatever, every discipline kind of coming together. I see a lot of evidence for interesting generalists with interesting points of view being able to kind of make some of the coolest things. So,
it depends on what you're doing and what kind of game you're making too, right? Like, I feel like if you're making something that's brand new, then I think that it pays to be a generalist, right? It pays to be a little bit more open to whatever. However, like if I wanted to make a fighting game, well,
sure.
Chances are I want a specialist, you know, because the audience demands certain things that like a generalist may not be aware of. So there is like, I don't know. I think it depends on what the project is,
yeah.
Honestly.
All right. I do want us to start wrapping up soon, but I want to give you both the chance to talk a little bit about what you're working on now, if you can. If you can't, that's totally fine. And you can send all our listeners to a website or any other materials you would like for us to look at. This is the time to plug things, folks.
Okay. We've been doing a lot of prototyping lately. Working on some new ideas. Can we talk about?
I don't think that's ready to talk about.
That's
but
okay.
We are about to release an arcade game.
Oh, that's right.
Which is Zombies Killer Queen Remix, which is a single player spinoff of Killer Queen.
Ooh.
It was like a project that we made during COVID because we couldn't be working on a 10-player game. And we released it on Steam, but now we're releasing an arcade cabinet version of it.
Excellent.
Soon. We also have a game called Black Emperor that is an arcade game that it's been out for a few years, but because of supply chain issues, we haven't really been able to manufacture the cabinet. So we're just about to have more of those in stock.
Nice.
We can get microchips again. And not buy them on the black market.
Yeah. We couldn't find our chips, so we had to find them in like from a black market supplier in China.
And it turns out that they're bad.
Yeah. But we finally got the legitimate chips, and so we're shipping that again, which is really exciting because
that's
the game
awesome.
Is great, and it's just. The timing, like it came out right before COVID, and we're finally now able to really get that out into the world. We just had a really big moment for it at PAX. It was like the final game of the, what did they call it, the Omegathon or something?
Oh, sure, sure. There's an Omega in there, I think, Omegathon.
Yeah, there's an Omega.
And so that it was like the final reveal for that, and it was a really good moment. But we are in a very exciting time right now because we are prototyping a lot. We have, I think, probably 6 or 8 prototypes, and we're trying to pick like which one or ones to move forward into production.
Some are more developed than others.
Sure.
But you know, it's been interesting. You know, we've spent really a lot of time like maintaining Killer Queen and like building the business and figuring out how the arcade business works and building like a distribution channel and all this stuff. And like getting back to making games is, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, that makes sense. It sounds like a very exciting kind of moment to be like, all right, all these things are brewing. We got to figure out the best way forward. So. Is there a website we should tell everybody to go to? Check out all your cool things, all your socials,
BumbleBearGames.com.
BumbleBearGames.com.
Our Instagram is BumbleBearGames. There's also a Killer Queen one, which I believe is Killer Queen Arcade. I don't know. I don't think Twitter really exists.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's like by next week, will it? You know?
Yeah. But our Instagram's probably the best.
I guess we should make a Threads. Oh, maybe we do have.
It's like, do we have
one? Do we have Threads?
We're all, I feel like even, you know, in the media too, we're all like, which platforms, you know, are going to be the next thing. So we're all doing
it. I guess we have our Discord.
We do have a Discord, BumbleBearGames. But actually, okay, the most important link to check out is if you go to our website or just Google this, there's a map. It's a Google Maps map with pins of where all of our arcade cabinets are.
Awesome.
And I think that's the most important thing, right? You can't play your games at home. You have to go to your local arcade. And so go to that map, find the closest one, and go play Killer Queen or Black Emperor.
And it is a little intimidating when you go to the arcade, but I think that you'll find that our players are pretty friendly and nice. And they're very desperate for more players, so...
they want you.
to have an incentive to join the cult.
That is fantastic. Well, I want to thank you both so, so much for your time and for the awesome journey. Like, I love doing this podcast because I really love to hear what it's really like, you know, and what it was really like to actually go through all the steps of something and, you know, figure out what the best way forward was and, you know, to cut through confusion and make your ways forward. It's always kind of awesome to hear about. And I think other devs also enjoy hearing about that kind of thing. So thank you both so, so much. BumbleBearGames.com, and go to that Google map. That's the map to look for. I kind of love that. I love the idea of sending folks to a Google map. It's kind of awesome. It's like one of these places. Find the pin and go there. So thank you both so much.
Thank you, Daniel.
Appreciated.